headlines this hour. Iran says discussions on key issues are yet to be concluded in the talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal in Vienna. Berlin seeks clarification on U.S. and Denmark's spying on German politicians, including the Chancellor Angela Merkel and President Frank-Walter Steinmeier. And official data shows that India's economy contracted by 7.3% in the fiscal year to March 2021 amid the coronavirus crisis. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital of Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us. Iran says that key issues still need to be resolved in Vienna talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal.
All of the Trump administration's sanctions against the Islamic Republic were aimed at depriving the country of the advantages of the nuclear deal and destroying the deal itself, and therefore those sanctions are against the text and the spirit of the JCPOA. In some key issues, serious decisions need to be made. I can say that we are at that point now.
Khatibzadeh made the remarks in his weekly press conference. He said that making decisions in key fields requires precision and time. Khatibzadeh noted that Tehran's main goal is to support its national interests, saying that it is now the time for the U.S. to make a definite political decision. Khatibzadeh once again stated that Iran would return to full compliance with the accord after a verifiable removal of all sanctions that the U.S. has imposed on the country since pulling out of the deal in 2018. Said that Washington is fully aware of Tehran's clear stance and that Iran has been moving in the same direction that it took since the very beginning of the nuclear talks. Iran's oil ministry has awarded a major oil development plan to its local companies. The project is aimed at increasing oil production in one of Iran's largest oil fields against the backdrop of U.S. sanctions that have choked Iran's crude production. Yusuf Jalali reports.
In a rare move, Iran's oil ministry has delegated a major oil project to local companies with the aim to boost crude oil production, as U.S. sanctions still cast their shadows on the country's petroleum sector. Worth $1.3 billion, the development project aims to boost the output in the Azadegan oil field to 320,000 barrels per day, up from the existing 140,000 BPDs.
We're running our oil industry amid the U.S. sanctions that seek to destroy the strategic sector. We're not allowed to import a single oil pipe. This is why we have made the greatest achievements during this difficult period. We continue to develop our oil fields to increase our output. We have done it before and we will do it now.
Azadegan oil field is located in southwest Iran and is in the vicinity of Iraq-Iran border. Its in-place oil capacity is estimated to be around 33 billion barrels, but with the current pace, only 1.5 billion barrels are recoverable. In 2009, China's oil giant CNPC won a $2.5 billion deal with Iran's oil ministry to expedite the recovery rate in the oil field. But in 2014, Iran revoked the deal due to China's foot dragging in fulfilling the project. Local firms say the move to handle such a mega project domestically is unprecedented in the history of the oil industry in Iran.
I should thank the oil ministry for its support to and reliance on Iranian companies to play a part in the development of the country's oil fields. This is a turning point in Iran's oil industry. We have long been relying on international firms to advance our projects, but now, thanks to the sanctions, we want to rely on ourselves, and we will prove that we can.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, following the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear deal and the reimposition of sanctions in 2018. Iran's oil output almost halved to 1.9 million barrels a day. As a result, Iran's exports have dropped to less than 1 million barrels per day, down from 2.5 million prior to the U.S.'s pullout from the nuclear deal. Now, the signing of these contracts is in line with plans to double oil production to 4.5 billion barrels a day in the next year.
As U.S. oil embargoes are still haunting Iran's crude, Tehran is resorting to domestic firms to keep the strategic sector up and running. Given the vast oil reserves waiting to be tapped into in the Azadegan oil field, experts say the development of the key reservoir means a significant boost to Iran's oil production and a strong comeback to the global market. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
France says allegations that the U.S. used Denmark's Secret Service to spy on top European politicians are extremely serious if they are proven to be true. Europe Minister Clement Beaune called for an investigation into the alleged cooperation between the Danish and American spying services. The French minister noted that facts must be first verified before any conclusion. Denmark's defense minister has declined to comment on the allegations, but told reporters that systematic eavesdropping of allies is clearly unacceptable. Meanwhile, Germany said that it is seeking clarification on the matter.
The federal government has taken note of the report and is in contact with all relevant national and international bodies for clarification.
According to an investigative report which covers the period from 2012 to 14, the U.S. spied on top politicians in Europe with the help of Denmark's Defense Intelligence Service. The targeted officials included the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and her then Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier. The report says Washington continued to spy on its allies even after the 2013 Snowden affair. Back then, U.S. intelligence contractor Edward Snowden revealed that the U.S. government was spying on its own citizens and its allies. The report shows that the United States, with the help of Danish intelligence services, spied on top European politicians from 2012 to 2014, as we just said. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the matter with our guests.
Now let's get some insight into this and maybe some more information. So joining me will be a couple of guests, our own Jerome Hughes in Brussels, also George Samueli, Senior Research Fellow with Global Policy Institutes out of Budapest. Let's go to Brussels. Jerome, tell us more about the allegations in this report in the first place.
Well, Bruce, I have to say, first of all, it's genuinely laughable that France says, you know, if it's true. Because, I mean, you'll remember back in 8 years ago in 2013, we covered every day of the European Parliament inquiry. It was called the Electronic Mass Surveillance of EU Citizens. Mm-hmm. And this inquiry went on. I mean, I didn't hear any of it reported on the mainstream media, but we covered it extensively. Mm-hmm. And it looked into the Snowden affair when, you know, his documents revealed that the CIA, the United States National Security Agency, had hacked into the European Union's SWIFT system, which collects a huge amount of data on EU citizens. The NSA, the spying agency, hacked into 38 embassies, politicians' phones, Angela Merkel's phone as well. We're talking about also the UK, the GCHQ, the inquiry heard that it was monitoring 600 million communications a day. The NSA had hacked into 9 of the top online, you know, internet firms like Facebook and Google and Microsoft and so on. And it was, I mean, the scale of it was absolutely enormous. So for France to say now that, you know, if it's true, it's terrible. But they're all spying on each other. I mean, it's well known that countries spy on each other. But what it does is, the broader point, of course, is it makes a mockery of we're constantly hearing from the EU about rule of law and the US and the UK and civil liberties and human rights and so on. And yet they're all spying on each other. And it also makes a mockery of organizations like NATO, the 30-country alliance. They're all spying on each other. And they're doing it, you know, sometimes they say it's for security reasons, for, you know, terrorism or whatever, but really that's the small element of it. The big part of it is for political gain, to get sort of information on sensitive political situations, and also economic. I mean, it's massive in terms of trying to get information on trade deals and so on. So it's happening all the time, and it genuinely, the reaction from Paris is laughable.
Okay. Now turning to Budapest, George, how do you look at this? I mean, how serious could the allegation be, and to what extent could it impact, if it's proven, of course, U.S. and its EU allies' relations?
Well, it won't have the slightest impact whatsoever because, of course, as your correspondent rightly pointed out, all this has been very well known by the European leaders, at least since the revelations by Edward Snowden. And at the time, the Obama administration suggested, no, that's it, we're not going to do this anymore, and then that's it. Now it turns out that, because this story refers to the spying that took place during the years 2012 to 2014. So in other words, the Obama administration was lying when it said in 2013 that we're not doing this anymore. Yet, of course, they were doing it. And of course, we can be sure that they continue to do so after 2014. Now, There are all sorts of big meetings. There's a G7 meeting taking place in less than 2 weeks, NATO meeting, and they're all going to be there. And they're all going to be there with President Joe Biden. Biden was, of course, vice president during the years in the Obama administration when the Edward Snowden revelations came about. So do we really think that there's going to be any serious confrontation with Biden? Are they really going to tell Biden, well, this is really absolutely shocking, horrible, terrible, we won't tolerate that anymore? No, of course not. They will no doubt politely ask Biden, is the U.S. Spying on our political leaders? Biden will say, not to my knowledge, they're not, and that will be the end of it.
Mm-hmm. And George, what about this French reaction? Has France itself not spied on other countries and allies?
Well, of course it has. And this, of course, raises another interesting issue, because at the time of the Snowden revelations, the U.S. media and European media as well kind of shrugged its shoulders and say, hey, we all spy on one another. Gentlemen read one another's mail. You know, this goes on all the time. Mm-hmm. Now, okay, if you're going to take that cynical attitude, then why the daily hysteria about Russia? I mean, oh, Russia's hacking, Russia's spying, cyber attacks and so on. So, even if all the allegations against Russia are true, all it means is that Russia is engaged in espionage, which, by their own disclosures, is something that the Europeans and the Americans do every day. So knock off all the self-righteousness and hysteria about what Russia is doing. I mean, look what the United States is doing to its own allies, not even against its adversaries.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. Jerome Hughes, our correspondent in Brussels, and George Samueli, Senior Research Fellow with Global Policy Institute, join us out of Budapest with their contribution and comments. And that's it for this news review.
Russia says it will deploy around 20 new military formations and units near its western borders by the end of the year in response to NATO's actions. The Russian Defense Minister, Sergei Shoigu, said that the actions of the West are destroying the world's security system and forcing Moscow to take what adequate countermeasures. He noted that NATO member states led by the U.S. are ramping up the intensity of their presence, while the number of their military drills is also increasing. Russia's military buildup followed an uptick in fighting in eastern Ukraine, where government forces and pro-Russia fighters have been fighting since 2014. Moscow said the deployments were in response to NATO's activities near its western borders. Official data show that India's economy contracted by 7.3% in the fiscal year to March 2021. Amid the coronavirus pandemic, Asia's third largest economy grew only by 1.6% in the last quarter of the fiscal year. That was after two consecutive quarters of contraction, which pushed India into its worst recession since gaining independence in 1947. But the prospects are not sunny amid a vicious second wave of the pandemic raging on. Over 7 million people lost their jobs only in April. New localized lockdowns are also expected to undermine a recent boost in economic activity. The government has so far refrained from announcing fresh major stimulus measures. India so far posted 28 million coronavirus cases and nearly 330,000 deaths. Israel's opposition leader Yair Lapid says that obstacles do remain in the way of forming a coalition to oust Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
There are still plenty of obstacles in the way of the formation of the new government. Maybe that's a good thing, because we'll have to overcome them together. That's our first test, to see if we can find smart compromises in the coming days to achieve the greater goal.
Lapid also lashed out at Netanyahu for calling the coalition plan a danger for the regime's security. The leader of the Yesh Atid party condemned the premier's comments as dangerous and unhinged. On Sunday, far-right politician Naftali Bennett, who chairs the Yamina party, said that he will form a coalition with Lapid. Under a prospective power-sharing deal, Bennett will serve as prime minister for 2 years, before being replaced by Lapid for the second half of the term. Lapid faces a Wednesday deadline from Israel's president to announce a new cabinet. International pressure is mounting on Israel as pro-Palestinian rallies continue around the globe. This was especially on display when a huge anti-Israel protest took place in Washington, D.C., which surely caught the attention of U.S. lawmakers and the U.S. president himself. The Israeli regime is now seeking a permanent ceasefire with resistance groups in the Gaza Strip. How costly was the 11-day war for Israel?
Israel's war on Gaza ended over a week ago, but voices in condemnation of the regime's crimes against the Palestinian people are still being heard around the world. Pro-Palestinian activists from across the United States descended on the capital, Washington, D.C., to hold a rally. The protesters called on Israel to stop killing Palestinians. They also called for an end to Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories and demanded that the U.S. government stop funding the regime.
For us, we need to demand the following. One, immediate, unconditional lifting of the siege on Gaza. Let me repeat, immediate, unconditional lifting of the siege on Gaza, because that is what international law requires. Second, we need to hold Israel accountable in the International Criminal Court. Netanyahu is a criminal war, committed war crimes. We need to take Israel to the International Criminal Court. Third, we need the implementation of the 4 Geneva Convention. Palestinians should be protected, not demonized.
It's definitely significant. There hasn't been a demonstration. They're not huge demonstrations. It's hundreds of people, but that's better than nothing at all. And it's not just in Washington, it's in New York, in Boston, in Michigan, Dearborn, there are, as you said, in London as well. So the visibility is there where it wasn't before on Palestinian issues. So this is really a change. And also there's now, it's quite acceptable for Congress and Senate to put forward bills to curb the so-called aid, the military gifts of $3 billion every year for Israel to destroy Palestinians.
Other speakers rejected attempts by corporate media to use the manufactured anti-Semitism crisis to undermine public support for the Palestinian cause.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. to know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. In a corner of my living room. The sound of water makes me calm. Tomorrow, I'm going to take a trip to Chahar Mahal and Bakhtiari province to Lordegan County. I'm going to take you to one of the most beautiful waterfalls of Iran, to Atashgah Waterfall. Atashgah Waterfall is located in the proximity of Kherson River, in Lordegan County in Chahar Mahal and Bakhtiari province. This waterfall is situated in a 3 kilometers long valley. Atashgah Waterfall is the longest waterfall of Iran. This waterfall originates from Dena Mountains in the central Zagros Mountains in south of Isfahan and north of Kohgiluye and Boyrahmad. The route of the waterfall from the spring to Kherson River is surrounded by a green environment with a species of trees and forest plants. The steep slope and ups and downs of this region has made multiple small waterfalls on the 3 kilometer way. I am now on my way to Atashgah Waterfall. On my right side, there is a picturesque valley which is very natural and a kind of untouched. In the middle of the valley flows a roaring creek. Do you hear the sound? Oh, well, this sound is not similar to that of my little fountain at home, yet it's as much relaxing. This region has an average to warm weather. However, inside the valley, the weather is so cool and pleasant. This is Atashgah Waterfall. Very beautiful. Around the waterfall, there are limestone and chalky rocks, and believe me, it looks like my little fountain at home. This waterfall is surrounded by old walnut trees, plane trees, oak trees, and ash trees. And I'd like to sit beneath this old plane tree and listen to the sound of Atashgah Waterfall. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The subcontinent.
Hi everyone, this is Mehdi and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to discuss why India's nationalist Hindutva supporters have backed Israeli aggression on Palestinians. And we shall take a look at the surge of terrorist attacks against the Hazara Shia community in Afghanistan.
The international community is enraged by Israel's sheer level of brutality against Palestinians, but amongst the global voices of condemnation, there are some people who have expressed support for the Israeli killings in the occupied territories. India's pro-government nationalists are amongst those who have thrown their weight behind the aggression in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and the Gaza Strip. The friendship between New Delhi and the Israeli regime has been increasing since Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party gained political power.
Members of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, BJP, and India's Hindutva nationalists are perhaps the only people who have expressed support for the Israeli assault against the Palestinian civilians. The growing relations between New Delhi and the Zionist Israelis seem to be worrisome for many Indians. Support for Israeli killings has been amplified on social media, particularly Twitter and Instagram, by top members of BJP as well as Hindutva activists. Amid the heavy bombardment of the occupied territories, BJP Member of Parliament Tejasvi Surya, who is well known for his anti-Muslim rhetoric, expressed solidarity with Israel on Twitter. We are with you. Stay strong, Israel. BJP spokesman from the northern Indian city of Chandigarh, Gaurav Goel, has posted a series of tweets in support of Israel. He tweeted a picture of Israeli forces. Dear Israelis, you are not alone. We Indians stand strongly with you. Another Twitter user who is followed by Prime Minister Modi and Home Minister Shah shared the video of a high-rise tower that hosted international media offices and was destroyed in Israeli bombardment. He mocked liberal Indians who oppose Israeli militarism, referring to Deepawali, the Hindu festival of lights. Happy Deepawali, liberals. India stand with Israel. Considering India's traditional policy of support for the Palestinian cause, Indians are concerned that the current government is distancing itself from the stance that has been the predominant view on Palestine since the independence from the British rule. Indian citizens seem to be worried that the ideas of the likes of Mahatma Gandhi and Jawaharlal Nehru are fading into oblivion.
India has historically supported the Palestinian cause as part of its anti-colonial solidarity following its independence from British rule in 1947. The country was the first non-Arab country to recognize the Palestine Liberation Organization, or the PLO, as the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. Thus, a PLO office was set up in New Delhi in 1975. However, the recent history of ties are telling a different story.
India recognized Israel in 1950, but diplomatic relations weren't established until the 90s. However, during the 1980s, India's position on Israel also began to shift, as did its relationship with the US at the expense of the Soviet Union. This led to normalization and full diplomatic ties between India and Israel in 1992. Since then, relations have grown exponentially, with arms sales becoming their main focus. India is currently Israel's biggest buyer of military equipment, accounting for 46% of Israel's arms exports. India and Israel's ties have strengthened significantly under Prime Minister Modi and his Israeli counterpart Benjamin Netanyahu. Founded in 1980, the Hindu Nationalist Party Bharatiya Janata Party rose from an anti-Muslim parliamentary movement, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, RSS. It maintained a racist belief in the supremacy of the Hindu nation that was modeled on German and Italian fascism. Following the rise of the Hindu hardliner BJP administration, headed by Prime Minister Narendra Modi, to power in 2014, India's bilateral relations with Israel intensified, as did the outpouring of online support for Israel by many of Modi's supporters following his 2015 announcement that he would visit Israel. In July 2017, Modi, who counts Netanyahu among his friends, finally made the visit, making history as the first Indian Prime Minister to do so.
Now, to have more insight on this issue, we are joined by Prashant Tandon, senior journalist. First of all, I would like to thank Mr. Tandon for being on the program and begin by asking, why is there a growing relation between India's right-wing Hindutva forces and the Israeli regime under the Modi government?
See, this is very strange and very paradoxical. The RSS, which is an ideological masters of the BJP, is a non-profit organization which controls the BJP and the ideological masters of BJP, the ruling party in India. They have a certain fascination towards Nazi Germany also, towards Hitler also. And it has been documented by the founders, which is this organization was founded in 1925. But in present day, they tend to you know, favor, or they have some attraction towards Israel, and it is their government which has formalized relations with Israel. India was not having full diplomatic relations with Israel, and it has only consulate in Mumbai, earlier it was called Bombay, to facilitate tourists to Israel. But they have formalized this only because of the reason that, you know, they've been fighting against Palestine and Muslims, and this Islamophobic agenda they also follow here in their domestic politics also. So it goes with their, you know, overall philosophy and the political tactics, that in domestic politics they follow Islamophobic politics, and they win elections because of that, with the polarization politics of among Hindus and Muslims, and at the global level also, they follow the same agenda.
As you know, Israel faces heavy criticism by almost all the international community for its assault on Gaza and the Palestinians, but it has received support from India's Hindutva. Why do you think Hindutva supporters are backing Israel on the Gaza bombings?
Third reason is that now we, India and the Israel have a very strong military ties and stuff like that. But the politics of BJP and their ideological master RSS is basically based on Islamophobia, which, you know, suits them in their domestic politics.
How do Indian liberal citizens and civil society see this rapprochement between New Delhi and the Israeli regime?
See, civil society in India and people in large, we have a historic, you know, ties with people of Palestine, a very emotional relationship. Not only just the civil society, I'm talking about the people of India. Yasser Arafat, you know, was darling of Indian public, and he was always given head of state status whenever he visited India. So Indian people have a very strong, not only just Muslims, the Indian people have a very strong emotional bonding with the people of Palestine and their cause. And but because of the present politics, of course, the civil society is very active after this recent, you know, bombings, and I myself participated in a couple of webinars, and these days we can do only digital, but some protests have also taken place somewhere, but mostly on digital platforms, you know, Indian civil society is very active and supporting the people of Palestine on these pressing times and hard times.
Now, do you think India's traditional policy of support for the Palestinian cause has changed under the current Indian administration, and if yes, why?
See, it is very strange that, you know, the party and the ideological masters, RSS, they are with Israel, and they are not with the people of Palestine, generally, in the social media outrage, and whenever they talk to in public or wherever. But Mr. Modi, which is the Prime Minister of India, is the first Prime Minister who visited Palestine in 2018. When Mr. Modi became Prime Minister in 2015, the Palestinian flag, the resolution in UN to have Palestinian flag in the campus of UN, India was one of the co-sponsors of that resolution under Mr. Modi. So we somehow continued this policy of, you know, supporting Palestine in multilateral forums, but certain changes have come. Like up to 2017, India's position on East Jerusalem as capital of Palestine were very, very clear, very vocally clear, and Indian establishment used to convey this in no uncertain terms.
Thank you, Mr. Tandon, for being on the program. Let's see how the people on social media see the situation.
Dr. Audrey Trushka has mentioned the Hindutva American Foundation as a vessel to facilitate nationalist relations with the Zionists. Outright, this account has highlighted the shared key strategy of Hindutvas and Zionists. Ehsan Elohi points out their close links to Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, or RSS, that is a known terrorist organization, the one responsible for Gandhi assassination.
Listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
People in Afghanistan are still mourning over the recent deadly attack against the Hazara Shia community. The Hazaras are known to be the most persecuted minority group in the region, targeted by Sunni extremists in Pakistan and Afghanistan. But the surge in such terrorist attacks is another proof of the failure on part of the Afghan and US allied forces to protect them. The name Hazara is said to be derived from a phrase which used to mean happy and sublime heart. After decades and even centuries of agonizing alienation, these Persian-speaking Shia Muslims still have sublime hearts, but they are not happy.
Over 85 people, mostly schoolgirls, were killed after several bombs exploded outside the Sayyidul Shuhada High School in capital Kabul. The bombs were timed to detonate as the girls were about to leave the school. Devastated members of the bereaved families buried their loved ones amidst mounting despair and anger over the government's and US-led forces' inaction to protect the community. The death toll from the school attack exceeded even previous massacres in this bustling neighborhood of a minority long singled out for persecution by the Taliban and Daesh. There was last October's attack outside an educational center that killed 30, and the May 2020 attack on a hospital maternity ward in which 15 women were killed, both tied to ISIL or Daesh. There was the September 2018 attack on a wrestling club that killed 20, the school attack that August in which 34 students were killed, and the 2017 mosque bombing in which 39 died, not to mention the massacres of Hazara in the civil war-torn Kabul of the early 1990s by the forces of warlord Abdul Rasul Sayyaf.
The school massacre happened only days after the US and NATO forces began their military withdrawal from the country. One of the pretexts used by Washington to invade Afghanistan was the rights of women and children. Now, after 20 years of ravaging the country, Afghan women are in worse shape than before. New reports show that about 40% of civilian casualties from airstrikes in the last 5 years are children. Another report has estimated that US and Afghan airstrikes have killed 785 children since 2016. Conflicting statements by Afghan and US officials on the perpetrators of these attacks, one blaming the ISIL, the other blaming the Taliban, may mean that the US forces are not aware of the realities on the ground or have decided to look the other way while Takfiri extremists are increasing their reach in the country.
The government blamed the Taliban for the attack, but the group denied any role accusing Daesh Takfiris or ISIL for the violent assault. However, there are numerous similar massacres in the recent history of this targeted minority by Taliban or Daesh. Many terror outfits in the country target Hazaras for their social progressiveness, especially education for teenage girls. For the Hazaras of sprawling Dasht-e-Barchi, home to over 1 million people, the precise identity of the killers didn't seem to matter all that much, particularly on that bloody day. Bearing the old wounds of perennial extremist violence, the helpless Hazaras say they had no protection by the Afghan security forces or the U.S. allied troops in any of such attacks they had been subjected to. Hazaras say over an hour after the attack, it was difficult to spot a single member of the security forces in the school's vicinity. Security forces were also absent during the funeral service on the following day, even though funerals are often targeted by the extremists.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Shabir Rezvi, political commentator. Now, Mr. Rezvi, welcome to the program. Let's start by asking, why is there a surge in terrorist attacks on Hazara Shia minority in Afghanistan?
I don't know if it's a surge as such. Yes, of course, what happened just about 10 days ago at the time of Eid al-Fitr was something quite large, and it impacted the female school. So, you know, the idea of surge, I mean, it's been a continuous sort of terrorism which has been taking place in Afghanistan for the last 20 years, and even longer, if you like. But certainly since the U.S. went in and bombed Afghanistan, then obviously all the sort of terrorist activities got ignited further. So it's been an ongoing struggle. But certainly, you know, now that the Americans have decided to leave, perhaps the Taliban and other groups are sort of flexing their muscle, if you like.
There are conflicting statements by Afghan and U.S. officials about the perpetrators of these attacks. Now, can you tell me who is behind the attacks?
Well, look, that's a very interesting question. You know, one can talk about who is behind it, but the fact of the matter is that U.S. is there. U.S. has got its soldiers. Obviously, they've reduced the people on the ground significantly, but nonetheless, America has created or did create Taliban 40 years ago when they wanted to get rid of the Russians, and subsequent to the invasion that took place 20 years ago, more other sort of mutations, if you like we have a COVID mutations taking place globally, there have been mutations of terrorists which have taken place in Afghanistan. And of course, they had a big victory in Syria and Afghanistan, which again is very clear. ISIL, Daesh, you name it, different brands which have come out over the last 10 years, they've always been supported, funded by USA and its allies, particularly Saudi Arabia. Because obviously the Saudis want to create a sectarian situation in Afghanistan like they did in Syria. So it is in the interest of Saudis and the Americans to have as much chaos in Afghanistan as possible.
Now let's continue by asking, how deeply have Daesh Takfiris or ISIS infiltrated Afghanistan, and what should or could be done to counter the threat of another Takfiri resurgence?
Well, this is a very difficult situation, as I was trying to sort of explain in my earlier conversation with you, is that because of the defeat that ISIS, ISIL, Daesh, you name it, as I said, many different brands which have over the last 10 years have raised their ugly head in Iraq and Syria, after their defeats in those parts of the world, it has been reported that a number of them have been shipped to other locations. For example, Afghanistan or certain African countries, Nigeria, or what we had recently in Mozambique. One doesn't know what the American plan is, what their strategy is to destabilize other nations by using these assets that they have created over the last so many years. So the reality is that there will be other elements, and to say that America wants to get rid of them, I think is really living in is delusionary, because America, as I said, has created and supported them, and they use these assets in different countries as and when it's desired by Washington.
Now, did U.S. forces stationed in Afghanistan notice the rise of Tak Furies, and how come they didn't do or say anything?
Well, these are their sort of creation. So when certain media would report that USA wants to control them and it wasn't aware of it, but these are their children. These are the monsters that have been created by USA, as I said earlier, 40 years ago, from all over the Arab world. People congregated in Afghanistan to fight the jihad against the heathen, non-believing communist regime that was in Kabul at that time. So that was the mantra which was given to the people, that, you know, you'd be fighting non-believers. But America used that, and it's not something, you know, a conspiracy theory and so on. American sort of politicians, American sort of secretaries of state, whether it's Clinton and others, have very proudly said that we created the Taliban. Therefore, one can expect that other terrorist groups that are operating in Afghanistan are perhaps new version of Taliban by a different name.
Thank you, Mr. Rezvi, for your precious time. Now let's see how people on social media see the situation.
Faizan Ali Fazi has slammed the Afghan government for its empty promises to protect the lives of the Hazara community. Sayyid Hassan Kazem wants people to focus on this point, that the Hazaras are only persecuted because they are Shia Muslims. This account has reiterated the sad fact about the world today, in which minorities like Hazara Shias are targets of xenophobia.
And that was our episode covering the growing ties between the ruling Hindu Nationalist Party of Premier Modi and the Israeli regime. Thank you. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care and bye-bye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.